And going back to something I said earlier, the word for me that defines my life and what I'm called to do and what I'm here on the earth to accomplish is re-enchantment, is what I'm calling it right now.
Most of us have two lives, the life we live and the unlived life within us.
We all have our own road to walk.
Nothing's perfect, and there's going to be a price for everything.
There are no rules.
Welcome to The Resistance, featuring meaningful conversations.
I think I'm grieving the death of part of me.
It's not about being the star and being seen. It's about
that explore that very space between who we are and who we say we want to be. I'm your host, Matt Connor.
How you doing, Matt?
I'm good, Jay. How are you today?
Good. I am Jay Kirkpatrick.
And I am Matt Connor.
Today's conversation is with one of my good friends, John Mark McMillan. Is this the first time you've talked to John Mark?
It is not. We talked a few years ago, but this is certainly the longest we've ever talked and the most in-depth that we've ever went.
One of the things about today's conversation and the cool thing about knowing John Mark is that he has a 20-30 minute conversation with Matt. And I think that the beautiful thing is that I've had hours and hours of conversations. You know, you get kind of the cliff notes of his heart for for the interview. And I feel like I've got the manuscript that isn't released to the public for the rest of the book. But today's conversation, he talks a lot in the area of, you know, he talks about a lot of things, but one of the areas is losing and struggling with being re-enchanted, that word re-enchanted. One of the things that's interesting about that is when your art is connected to something above the musical or the, skill of the art, there's something within the art that connects people to it. And his is this, in this area of spiritual faith, connecting people to this other, this God, this greater. And when you're struggling to hold on to that, the thing that's at the core of your art, when you're struggling to hold on to that, and it's such a crucial thing, the resistance in that moment has to almost feel, and I don't know what you think, Matt, but has to almost feel like you're dying and you don't know what to do.
Yeah. You know, this conversation is kind of devastating in some ways because there's this sense of, you know, I think anyone can relate to this, you know, whether someone believes spiritually this or that, there's this idea of, oh my gosh, this thing that I'm supposed to offer to people, I don't feel it anymore. And that's what he said. He says, people are coming to me for help with their faith, for insights, for emotions, for these moments in a way, or some kind of lyrics or direction. And then he says, you know, and for a decade, I was losing my faith. I'm wrestling with doubts. I don't even know what I believe anymore. And so, you know, that's a really weird thing for someone of his stripes professionally. But I think anyone can really understand that as a writer, what do you do when there's nothing to write anymore? Like when the inspiration's gone, or the same thing with painting, like whatever the endeavor is, I don't have it anymore, but the marketplace is demanding more. The audience is demanding more. Like, what do you do with that? And so I love this conversation because John Mark, fortunately for him, found a way back around to feel re-enchanted and then knows what he wants to bring to the world. But it's not an easy journey.
I would say this conversation is for those people who maybe you've lost something that's at the core of what you want to do and what you've been doing, and you have a decision to make. Are you going to fight to push all these other things out of the way that have taken that from you to get it back? Or are you going to just start producing a product? Or are you going to quit? You know, there's all these decisions. And I think a lot of people, a lot of artists are at that crossroads constantly because there's a lot of things vying for their heart, their motivation, and there's a lot of things maybe trying to kill it too. So I think that is what this conversation is about. So we hope you enjoy today's conversation with John Mark McMillan.
Hello and welcome to The Resistance. My name is Matt Connor. Today, I'm privileged to chat with John Mark McMillan. John Mark, how are you, sir?
I am actually wonderful. I'm doing really great. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, I know, you know, you've already told me you're familiar with our source material. Just as a reminder for our listeners, the whole podcast is centered on a book called The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. And John Mark, I'd love to get you to respond to one of the opening lines from that book. It says, most of us have two lives, the life we live and the unlived life within us. And between the two stands the resistance. How would you respond to that at this point of your career and life? What is that resistance for you these days?
I think, oddly enough, the resistance for me is the balance of it all. I have a lot of opportunity, and I always feel like, you know, super weird talking about it, just because some people's resistance is they literally can't figure out how to pay their bills. You know what I mean? And I feel like my challenge is, like, even though they're very real to me, I always want to be aware there are people with real challenges in the world, you know, but my challenges at the moment are figuring out how to make everything work together. My family life, my work life, my art, my writing and my spiritual life, trying to figure out how to make these things all sort of coexist together, I think is really, really hard. And so really resistance for me a lot of times the challenge for me really is organizing it all. And I think there's an economy to life in that you can do almost anything you want to do to a point. Now, obviously, like, I was never going to be a professional basketball player. Right. But, you know, there are things I could have done. You can do almost anything to a point, but you can't do everything. Right.
Yeah.
I'm learning at this stage of life what matters the most out of all the things that I could do. Because there's a lot of things I could do. But if I want to do anything well, I only have so many years to focus on that one thing. And so deciding what that one thing is hard for me. I want to be a good dad. I want to be a good husband. I want to be a good friend. And then what do I want to do? Because being good at anything means giving yourself fully to it. And I have a friend who's a lawyer, and he's one of the smartest people I've ever met. He's a lawyer. He lives in Manhattan. He, obviously you can imagine how good at arguing you have to be a lawyer in Manhattan and be successful for any amount of time. They have four kids. I mean, he's a smart guy. He'll call me to talk. I'm like, man, sometimes I feel so not smart talking to you. Why do you call me? And that wasn't a defense. He and I weren't arguing. I was just like, sometimes I wonder why. And he's like, well, he's like, there's a lot of different types of intelligence. He's like, I used to work with this guy selling cars when I was young. I had a job selling cars. And he's like, he was the dumbest guy in the world. But it must have been that all his intelligence was focused in one area, because I couldn't sell a car and he was killing it. It said all his he must have taken every intelligent point he had and dropped it in the sell cars and hook up with chicks bucket, because that's all he was good at. But and this is coming from the most intelligent guy I ever met. That's
funny. John Mark, let me ask you, how old are you now?
I am 40.
Okay. The reason I ask is because as you were talking, I heard some of my own internal language there. I'm 43, and something happened to me between 38 to 40, and then now I'm living it, and it's only more true now. I mean, there's that whole, you know, midlife cliche, and I haven't bought a car or anything like that, but there's this idea that I'm finding that turning 40 or being in that general zone was clarifying for me in a lot of ways, and not like in a morbid sense, like, oh my gosh, life is so mortal and fleeting. You know, I'm not freaking out at the lack of years I have left. I'm just aware of them. And then therefore it makes me want to, in a clarifying, cleansing way, put myself toward those things.
Yep. 100%. 100%. And also, I think when you're young, you know, we have these ideas of success that we develop very early in life. And I don't think we realize how far we carry those things. We all have this, we all sort of decide based on what happens to us when we're young, what success looks like, does success for some people look like being connected to successful, powerful people? Or maybe success means looking special, standing out from the group. Or does success mean winning, being in charge, and knowing that you are surpassing other people? Because I was talking the other day to a friend of mine, because we're talking about the tour shutting down and how it affects people financially. And, you know, we've had to move our tour and cancel dates and reschedule dates and things like that. And I was like, you know, if I'm totally honest, the money is obviously a challenge, you know, like that's definitely not something to ignore. But more than anything, like I just wanted people to come out to my shows because I want that. That's what made me feel successful, is whether or not people showed up. And I realized, like, I was willing to spend all kinds of money just to get people to come. That's really interesting, because I have other friends who would be like, just do an acoustic tour and just make all the money. Who cares? I was like, yeah, but you don't understand. This is what I need to feel important. I need to prove to myself that people want to come see my rock shows. That's what matters to me. But I was very aware that, like, oh, there is a lie that I've told myself that persists even at 40 years old, that I need all these people because, gosh, well, it's not just my ego. I mean, I'm going to be honest. It's not just my ego, right? Like, I love playing. In fact, I think that there are things I love more than the ego boost. There definitely are. The connection with people and the expression and the being in the room and feeling each other's presence as you sing and you make this music, you know, and for me, it's not performing for a crowd. It's like this massive connection, you know? And then you have the high for about an hour afterwards, and that's it. They're like, okay, that was great. Now I got to do it again, or I'm not going to be okay with myself. But I realized in that conversation, like I realized like what my motivation was, at least in the moment I had that conversation. I was like, is this really what drives me? Like, am I really just trying to get people in the door? And so like this phase of my life has really been about like, how do I like bring actual value to people? How do I get beyond doing this for my own self-worth? Am I doing it for my own self-worth? I've had to ask, or my own sense of self-worth. I've had to ask myself that question.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, I have to ask myself that question constantly, right? Because we don't just move from being young and ego-focused to being mature and less ego-focused. It's a process, right?
Yeah.
Ego's always kind of hanging around with us. And in itself, he's not a bad guy. He just doesn't need to be driving the bus. He needs to be in the back of the bus cracking jokes.
Somebody needs to revoke that license. Yeah.
Exactly. That guy needs to chill because he drives way too fast. He takes way too many risks. And we like him because of what he brings to the table. He's encouraging and he helps get things done. But at the end of the day, like, I don't want him behind the wheel.
how do you parse what you're talking about? Because it sounds like it's all part of the same. Like if it was a plant, it would sound like all part of the same stalk. Because you were describing earlier, it sounded like what you were saying was, "Gosh, part of this is my validation, my need to be validated by a room full of people responding to the lights and the sounds and what I have to offer." But what you have to offer is also the good side, right? If you say that with a different inflection, you're saying that's what you have to offer to the world. You being you and expressing what you can only bring to a group of people, to connect with them, to create community, to give them a moment, even music that lasts with them in meaningful ways and resonates with their experiences. All of that is so positive. And yet, I wonder how you differentiate that between your need for validation and doing what you're supposed to be doing.
Totally. I think it works a little bit like this. And when I say young, it's not a specific age because this happens to people at all different times, but it generally goes from young, older to more mature. Usually don't move from more mature to immature, though that probably does happen sometimes with people based on decisions. I don't know. I'm not a psychologist, but I think, you know, at first you're like, you're building the ego. You're figuring out who you are, who you think you are, who you're supposed to be. And it's important because you need something to push against in order to grow. It's like lifting weights, right? But like the weights on the bench are literally nothing. You're not doing work. You're faking work in order to build yourself up. And you need those muscles to exist in the world. Then you reach a point where you're like, I want to move something. I want to actually use this thing to do something. And you start to, maybe your ego gets hurt or you start to see it for what it is. And like, you know, for me, it was like that. Then I'm like, I'm going to be anti-ego. I'm going to be the monk. I'm going to be the selfless, which in itself can become another version of your ego. But, you know, you grapple with it. And then I feel like you come to the point where you're like, okay, like this is me and it's not the worst thing in the world. And I'm going to live with this. And instead of focusing, because I guess phase two is still sort of a focus on the ego, right? Phase one is you're building the ego up. Phase two is you're like, you're going to push the ego out the door. But you spend your whole life wrestling that thing to push it out the door when you could have spent a decade doing good things. So then you reach this point, which is where I feel like I am now, where I'm like, ego is in the room. Hey, bud, how you doing? High five. What are you doing this weekend? Let's hang out. I'll talk to you later. Instead of trying to push the ego out the door, it's sort of like admit that the ego is in the room, but my focus isn't on whether or not it's the ego or not. So like, I want to go do a show, and it's not like if the show is going to make me feel great and the show is going to validate me, I'm not going to stop it just because I don't want the false validation. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to shift focus. It's not really about whether or not I'm validated or not. It's about what I have to bring to the human beings who are in front of me. And I feel like this is a new development for me because I went through the sort of self-flagellating sort of midlife crisis where I decided I was evil and I needed to like destroy any idea of who I was outside of like, you know, the pure, true self, or how do I become like a Christ-like figure in and of myself, right? I should have been asking the question, instead of asking, how do I not be this egocentric person? I should ask the question, how do I serve all these people in front of me? And so I started asking that question. And you know what? I hit a wall probably a year ago, and I hit walls a lot. And to be honest, like what I'm talking about here, I feel like is a cycle that I go through. And I think I handle it better, a little better each time. But I hit this wall and I realized like, why are things not working? Why are things not working? Why am I not happy in my work? Why am I not connecting to people in the way that I used to or feel like I'm supposed to? And I realized like I had lost all of my vision. I lost all of my vision, I think, because of wrestling with this idea of who I am and wrestling with this idea of the way I want to present myself. Early on, once again, wrestling to become something great, and then later wrestling to destroy that idea because I was embarrassed or ashamed that I had been such an ego-driven human being. I got to the end of that process, and I didn't have a vision. And I had to spend some real time asking myself, how do I even find a vision? What do I really even want to do? I literally had a hard time answering what I actually even wanted to do. And I spent some time, I read some business books and read some psychology and had conversation with friends and watched YouTube videos and listened to podcasts. And I took notes and I decided like, okay, I'm going to come up with a vision statement and a mission statement. You know, even just for my sanity. And early on, they were so flaky. I have this friend. He's another lawyer. He lives in Southern California. And he's kind of my business mentor a little bit. And he looks after me some. And he's like, yeah, send it to me. And I look over it. And I remember sending him my first things. He's like, okay. I could tell. Like, he's like, I have no idea what you're talking about here. You need to clarify what it is you're doing in the world. But over time, it started to get clearer and clearer and clearer, even though I started with the super vague. And I was able to narrow it down to a single word. And for the first time in my life, I can tell you why I exist, why I do what I do in my work, in my community, and even with my family. I have a very distilled vision right now. It's not easy to do. I'm not saying it's simple, but I think for the longest time, I was focused on the wrong things. I was focused on me to be great. And then I was focused on trying not to be the egocentric human being that I thought I'd been before. And I realized I was still focused on myself the whole time. And focusing on yourself, I'm not an anti-self person. Like, goal in life is not to be unselfish. The goal in life is to be giving. And in being giving, you become unselfish. It's kind of like light and darkness. Darkness literally isn't a thing. Darkness is literally nothing. Darkness is only the absence of light. Silence is only the absence of sound. Well, selfishness is really just the absence of giving, the absence of good, the absence of putting yourself forth. And so, like, when you focus on being, whether or not you're a selfish person, I think it defeats the purpose because you're still sort of like focused on yourself. And maybe that's what it was for me. And then when I decided to try and turn my energies and focus and figure out how to serve the world, because I do believe that I have talents. I struggle in some areas. I've not always been the best singer. I'm not the best musician. But there is something I can do that I think not a whole lot of people in the world can do. And that's tell a story for a certain group of people who, for some reason, have connected with me on a heart level. And I owe them to give them my absolute best. And that doesn't mean I'm better than anyone else at what I do. It just means I've been given an opportunity and a place to speak into people's lives. And so I had to decide, what is it that I've been put on this earth to say to those people? And when I connected with that, something changed. All of a sudden, I had this purpose that I hadn't had before. And all of a sudden, energy picked up. In the process of creating a new album, I started to recognize my place as a leader and a servant instead of just the artist. You know, in the past, I'm like, I'm going to be the artist and then my business team, you guys are the business guys. I'm going to make the music and you guys figure out how to pay for it. You guys figure out how to get it in front of people. But I realized that, like, those aren't two different things. And when I kind of hit a wall, I had to sort of change my entire business team. Not just on a whim, you know, we'd been together a long time and it was just time for a change. And it was really hard at first because I had to take the lead in areas I hadn't been involved in for 7 years. And so all of a sudden it's like, how do I deliver a song? I had to hire some help, but how do I connect with people? Why aren't people looking at my Instagram anymore? I don't know what's going on. And I had to make some really big changes, but it was so good for me to be in that driver's seat because it required that I have vision anymore. And going back to something I said earlier, the word for me that defines my life and what I'm called to do and what I'm here on the earth to accomplish is re-enchantment, is what I'm calling it right now. And I didn't coin that phrase. I didn't come up with that word. Someone on the internet said, sounds like what you're talking about is re-enchantment. I was like, it is exactly what it is.
How would you define that?
Well, I think that it comes down to gratitude. But for me, gratitude feels a little over simplistic. Gratitude is like when someone does something nice for you, you respond, you say thank you. So it's gratitude. And that was the original word, was gratitude. But I realized it's more than gratitude. It's more than just being kind. It's more than just being appreciative of the good things you have. To me, re-enchantment was about a new way to see the world, the whole world. So Einstein says that there are two ways to see the world. You can either see the world, you either see the whole world as a miracle or you see the whole world as not a miracle. It's either all a miracle or none of it is a miracle. Digging into the deeper place in my life, I grew up in a community that is very miracle driven. My dad was really big into faith healing. I love my dad. We get along real good. And I love that part of him. He's passionate about it. He believes in it. He wants to see people live better lives and he prays for them. And he asks God to heal them. But I grew up in this sort of miracle culture and I struggled with it. I really, really struggled with it. And I walked through this season of about 10 years where I almost completely lost my faith. And I remember I was, and it's hard when you have all these people. And see, this goes back to one of my original problems is, how am I supposed to serve people when they come to me for answers about faith? This community comes to me for answers about faith, and I'm trying to be a servant here. They come to me with questions about faith, and then I'm secretly over here like losing mine. Then what do I do?
Yeah, how do you give what you're losing?
Exactly. And so, like, part of it is I just talked about my faith and struggling with my faith. That's kind of another story. But I remember I was sitting in, oddly enough, I was sitting in a castle in outside of London. I don't guess it's really a castle, but it's a manor. I mean, it looks like a castle, right? I think, like, but I was in a castle. It's like Harry Potter. I was sitting in a big armchair, you know, with paintings on the wall and raging fire. And this, I'd met this Scottish friend who's become a friend of mine. And I don't know why. Maybe it's just me. Sometimes I'll open up to just about anybody. And I was just opening up to him about what I was going through. I'm so stuck on all these things that I don't know. Everyone, you know, everyone wants to ask me what's real and what is true and what I believe. And I'm like, I want to believe all this stuff, but I don't know, you know, I don't know. I'm sort of like celebrated as like this Christian writer who's written some songs that people all over the world sing, and they want me to write more, and they tell me how like they've changed their lives and things. And I'm sitting here like, I'm glad they've changed your life, but like, I don't have anything to give you right now because I'm struggling with disbelief. You know, and I was sitting there having this conversation about everything that I don't know. And he said to me, well, what do you know? What do you know? How about focus on what you do know? It took me a year or two to process that conversation. But I was sitting here today thinking about that conversation and thinking about, like, here's the thing about faith is what I don't know is not really that important. Because what I do know is so immersive. What I do know is, maybe, I don't know, is immersive the right word? What I do know, I could give my life to what I do know. I could give multiple lifetimes to what I do know, and I would never run out. I wouldn't lose a minute. Because here's what I do know. I know number one is that I am obsessed. I am totally infatuated with the forces that led me to exist. I have been my entire life. And number two is that I can't help but see those forces at work in all the human beings that float in and out of my life. And I thought the other day, I was like, this is insane. I lost my faith. Not really. Didn't really lose my faith, if you really want to get down to it, but I thought I was losing my faith, and I dug down to the bottom of who I was. And what's at the bottom of who I was? What's at the bottom of me is I am obsessed with God. I love God. I'm obsessed with the powers that led me to exist. I absolutely love God. I'm not going to sit here and define exactly who and what God is for you at this moment, but at the very least, loving God means being grateful for the forces that led you to be. And then I see those forces at work in the people around me. And I was like, are you serious? Did I just take the longest lap of all time and land right back, right back on top of the two pillars of Christianity? I was like, I think I actually did, you know?
but with clarity and with experience.
Exactly. And that's re-enchantment for me. That's re-enchantment. Re-enchantment is realizing that every moment is a miracle. Every single moment is a miracle. Every person is a miracle. And not just so that you approach the world in a way that the world deserves, not just that you treat people right. I mean, obviously, but because like our time on this plane of existence is insanely short. And we're missing out on the greatest things if we haven't taken the time to realize exactly how miraculous it all is. And that goes back to me growing up in miracle revival land. Everyone's pushing for revival, 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 revival. God's going to come. He's going to change everything. He's going to do the good. We want more. I mean, those are worship songs we used to sing. More Lord, more Lord. And I realized I'm living in a miracle. And when I was younger, looking for miracles sometimes is also a distraction from living in the miracle that you're in. I'm not anti-miracle. I just kind of, with Einstein, hear that it's either all a miracle or none of it's a miracle. And that's what re-enchantment is for me. Can I make sounds through music that you feel, mostly with your ears, that trick you into feeling the reality of your significance in the universe? Can I do that? If I can, that's what I want to give my life to.
Why do you say it that way? Trick people into something.
Because art is always a trick. Picasso says that art is the lie that tells the truth. There's a misdirection that's required to help you see what's real. In art, especially the visual arts, like when you're looking at a photo, you're not looking at something real. You're looking at light that has left an impression, either digitally or on film, but you're not seeing an actual thing. And so the role of the artist is to exaggerate a thing so that you will notice something that you didn't notice before. So you'll notice a very real thing, but you have to do something very unreal to your brain to distract you away from the things that are keeping you from seeing it. I think Flannery O'Connor said, because you're hard of hearing, we make loud sounds. Because you don't see well, we draw large, startling figures, something like that, right? Well, it's the same with art. I'm not trying to lie to you, but I am trying to like exaggerate an aspect of the world for you so that you will actually take notice of how good that thing actually is, because right now you're totally distracted by all the other things that are filling up your your inbox, your Instagram feed. It's like, how do I get your attention? And maybe that's what like a painter does, is because, you know, painters and illustrators can illustrate, good ones can illustrate just like a photograph, but they don't, because they want to exaggerate features in order to focus your attention on those things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sounds like then to move around the intellectual use. I mean, I'm assuming a lot of what you're talking about is using emotion to do just that.
I think so. And in music, there's some really interesting things that happen to your brain when you listen to music. If you've ever watched a film without the music, there's something that's missing from that film. And you know, obviously you can go on YouTube and every idea that's ever been thought of is on YouTube, and you can find like the intro to sitcoms where they've changed the music. There was one, I'm trying to remember what it was. What you talking about, Willis? What was that show?
Different Strokes.
Different Strokes. And the intro, like, I don't know if you remember the intro to Different Strokes, but the rich old man, you know, and rich old white man is driving around in his Rolls Royce, and he picks up these two young African-American boys and he takes them back to the place. And like the music that's playing is exciting. Like all of a sudden these kids are going from rags to riches, but someone replaced it with really creepy music. And all of a sudden you're like, what is he doing with these young boys? What is happening? Oh my gosh. And no one, and this is my point, like no one told you to think different thoughts. Not for a second. All we did was change the music. All of a sudden the music has tricked you into a new posture towards what you're seeing. All of a sudden you're not stoked for Willis and Arnold as they're shooting basketball and they're going up to the penthouse. They're living it up. All of a sudden you're like, what's going on? Is this okay? Are they going to be okay? Why is this weird old man taking these kids away? This is weird. I'm scared.
Now it's a Jordan Peele movie.
Exactly. But music can do that. Music has the power to do that. It has the power to contextualize the brain and create a posture towards certain things. And so it's the lie that tells the truth, in a sense. Like, how do I posture you towards things that I know you want? How do I help you feel the reality of your significance in the universe?
What song best exemplifies that? You stumbled upon this word, re-enchantment. It informs what you do or what you want to bring to the world. Mm-hmm. Is there a song that best exemplifies, like, this is what I'm talking about?
I'm not sure. You know, the whole new album, Peopled with Dreams, is more of my journey to this point. And I started to discover in the middle of the record what we're doing, that gratitude was the central theme. There's a song like The Road, The Rocks, and The Weeds. The final verse is, shall I plant sequoias and revel in the soil of a crop I know I'll never live to reap. It's hard to remember my songs when I'm not singing them. So my body to my maker and my heart to my savior, and spread me on the road, the rocks, and the weeds. And to me, the road, the rocks, and the weeds are the rest of life, right? They're the rest of life. They're the parts of life. It's the resistance. It's the road, the rocks, and the weeds are the part of life like you put up with, that you deal with. And I noticed for the first time in my whole life that I was reading the parable of the sower. To me, all of a sudden, it wasn't significant that, you know, Jesus talks about spreading the word, the sower sowed the seed, and the seed was the word of God, and the word of God had to be Jesus. That's what John says. In the beginning was the word. It's not talking about the Bible. Jesus, the sower was not spreading the Bible all over creation, right? No, the sower was spreading the word that John spoke of. It's Jesus himself. Jesus, the image of the invisible God, God himself. He was spreading God around the world. And early on, obviously, we all think about the good soil, the ears to hear. But for a moment, it hit me. That's like, what does this say of the sower that he also spreads himself out on the bad soil? That was significant and kind of beautiful. Because we spread our lives out and we hope that we, in the short time, like pour ourselves into good soil. But there's kind of a beauty to being willing to be spread out also on the road, the rocks, and the weeds. The road, to me, is significant because I spend a lot of time on the road.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of time on the road. The weeds are significant because I spend a lot of time in the weeds. You know, I'm up to my ears. And the rocks are significant to me because I spend a lot of time beating the wall. But it's kind of like if the maker is willing to be spread out on all the parts, then, you know, like my life is okay. All that I've wasted on the road, all the time I spent in the weeds, all the bruises from hammering the rock, all of those things like have a purpose. The beauty is that I'm in it with the maker. I'm not just here by myself. I'm not just wasting my own life. I'm wasting it with the creator, with the creation, with the universe. Now I sound like a Buddhist or something. I don't know. I got lost.
No, I love it, man. I love it.
But to me, that song is about gratitude, finding gratitude in even the hardest places, finding gratitude in the most difficult places in life. So that's one of the songs, you know, that I think begins to express this idea of re-enchantment.
You've been listening to The Resistance. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate us on iTunes and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And for more information and further episodes, you can find us at listentotheresistance.com. Engineering, production, and additional music by Jake Kirkpatrick. My name is Matt Connor, and I'm your host. Thanks for listening.